Chapter 7. I only agreed to do an interview with Rolling Stone because I was bored out of my mind. The 1976 Elton John World Tour was supposed to be a journalist-free zone. I didn't need to do any press to promote it because every date had sold out instantly. But I'd been stuck in a suite at the Sherry Netherland in New York for 2 weeks. We were playing a run of shows at Madison Square Garden, and I'd completely run out of things to do when I wasn't on stage. It was hard to get out of the hotel. It was August and Manhattan was unbearably hot, but there was a crowd of fans permanently stationed outside the entrance. If I managed to get past them, wherever I went there was chaos. I'd literally seen little old ladies get knocked over and trampled by people who were trying to get a look at me. Not a site designed to make you feel good about your celebrity. Still, I'd tried to keep myself occupied. I'd been to see or been visited by everyone I knew that was in town. I'd been out clubbing to 12 West and visited a radio station called WNEW. They'd given me champagne, an act of generosity they swiftly came to regret when I went on air immediately afterwards and offered listeners my full and frank appraisal of a rock critic called John Rockwell, who'd given me a bad live review. I bet he's got smelly feet. I bet he's got bogeys up his nose. I went shopping, although I realised I might have exhausted the possibilities of retail therapy, when I found myself buying a cuckoo clock that, instead of a cuckoo, had a large wooden penis that popped in and out of it every hour. I gave it to John Lennon when I went to visit him. I thought it was a good present for a man who had everything. John and Yoko were as bad as me when it came to shopping. The various apartments they owned in the Dakota were so full of priceless artworks, antiques and clothes that I once sent them a card rewriting the lyrics to Imagine. Imagine six apartments, it isn't hard to do. One is full of fur coats, another's full of shoes. They owned herds of cows, for God's sake, prize Holstein cattle. Years later I asked what had happened to them. Yoko shrugged and said, "Oh, I got rid of them. All that mooing." But having delivered a penis-themed cuckoo clock to John Lennon, I had nothing else to do. Or at least nothing that I wanted to do enough to see a little old lady get hospitalised in the process. I just mooched around the hotel. The bands certainly weren't in the mood to hang out with me because I'd fired them all the night before last, just before we went on stage. It had been a weird tour. Commercially, it had been a huge success, and on one level, it had been fun. Kiki D had come along with us to sing Don't Go Breaking My Heart, which, despite Bernie's profound misgivings, went to number one on both sides of the Atlantic that summer. In Britain, we'd travel around by car, visiting the tourist sites between shows, stopping off for ice creams and ducking into pubs for lunch. In America, the shows had been massive events. Hollywood stars backstage, a big performance in Massachusetts for the American Bicentennial on the 4th of July, where I dressed up as the Statue of Liberty. A guest appearance from Divine, who shimmied away around the band despite the fact that one of his high heels broke off the minute he got on stage. And I met Elvis Presley backstage at the Capitol Center in Landover, Maryland, a couple of nights before I played there myself. I took Bernie with me, and my mum. It seemed to make sense. Mum had introduced me to Elvis's music. Now I was going to introduce her to Elvis himself. We were ushered into a dressing room full of people. I was used to rock stars who went everywhere mob-handed, but I'd never seen anything like Elvis's entourage. He was surrounded by cousins, old buddies from back home in Memphis, people who seemed to be employed specifically to hand him drinks and towels. When I squeezed past them to shake his hand, my heart broke. There was something desperately, visibly wrong with him. He was overweight, grey and sweating. There were expressionless black holes where his eyes should have been. He moved like a man coming round from a general anaesthetic. Weird and sluggish. There was a trickle of black hair dye running down his forehead. He was completely gone, barely coherent. Our meeting was short and painfully stilted. I was simultaneously starstruck and horrified, which is hardly a recipe for sparkling conversation. And Elvis, well, I couldn't work out whether Elvis just had no idea who I was. There seemed every chance he had no idea who anyone was. Or whether he knew perfectly well and wasn't very pleased to see me. Everyone knew that Elvis wasn't keen on competition. There was a crazy rumour going around that when he visited Richard Nixon in the White House, he had literally complained to the US president about the Beatles. And a couple of years before, I'd been contacted by his ex-wife Priscilla saying that their daughter, Lisa Marie, was a huge fan and asking if I would meet her as a birthday treat. We had tea together at my house in LA. Maybe he was angry about that. I asked him if he was going to play Heartbreak Hotel, and he grunted in a way that strongly implied he wasn't. I asked for his autograph and saw his hands shaking as he picked up the pen. The signature was just about legible. Then we went to watch the show. Occasionally you would see something spark, a flash of the incredible artist he had been. It would last for a couple of lines of a song and vanish again. My main memory is of him handing out scarves to women in the audience. In the past, he'd been famous for giving away silk scarves on stage, a grand gesture befitting the king of rock and roll. But times had clearly changed, and these scarves were cheap, nylon things. They didn't look like they would last long. Nor did Elvis, as Mum pointed out. "He'll be dead next year," she said as we left. She was right. But for weeks afterwards, I couldn't stop turning over our meeting in my mind. It wasn't just that he was in such a bad way, although that was incredible in itself. The last thing I'd expected to feel when I finally met Elvis was pity. It was that I could understand a little too easily how he ended up like that, closeted away from the outside world. Maybe he'd just spent too much time trapped in expensive hotels with nothing to do. Maybe he'd just seen one little old lady too many stretched away and decided the outside world wasn't worth the bother. For all its success, the tour had felt very familiar. The stadiums, the starship, the celebrities, even the set we played. We had a new album recorded, a double called Blue Moves. But it wasn't due out until the autumn, and I'd learned my lesson about inflicting new material on an unsuspecting audience at Wembley the year before. Especially if the material was like the stuff on Blue Moves. I'm very proud of it, but the music was complex and hard to play. Quite experimental and jazz-influenced. And its mood was very somber and reflective. Bernie pouring his heart out about his divorce from Maxine and me writing music to match. I even wrote some lyrics myself. The opening lines of Sorry seems to be the hardest word. The fallout from another disastrous infatuation with a straight guy. What can I do to make you love me? What can I do to make you care? It's a great album, but it's not exactly the work of two people who are cartwheeling down the street overflowing with the joys of life. And that was the real problem with the tour. The holiday in Barbados had been great, but it seemed like a distant memory. I was back in exactly the same place emotionally as I had been when I threw myself into the swimming pool in LA. My mum and Durf had found me a new home. Called Woodside. It certainly sounded nice. A huge mock Georgian house in Old Windsor with 37 acres of land. But I couldn't tell you for sure how nice it was because I'd hardly been there since I moved in. I'd had enough time to ask Durf to build some shelves for my record collection and to install a small menagerie of pets. A rabbit called Clarence, a cockatoo called Ollie, and Roger. A minor bird that someone had taught to say piss off. A phrase he later disgraced himself by using in front of Princess Margaret when I invited her for lunch. But no sooner had Roger arrived and told everyone present to piss off than I took his advice. There were always recording sessions to do. Tours to go on. I still loved playing live, but I was physically spent. I'd started having seizures. Almost like epileptic fits. Not often, but often enough to scare me. I'd had a brain scan, but the neurologist I saw couldn't find anything wrong with me. Although I'm sure if I'd told him what was going up my nose on a regular basis, he could have made an accurate diagnosis on the spot. Bernie didn't look in much better shape than me. Since his divorce, the only time you saw him without a beer in his hand was when he put it down to do a line of coke. I started suggesting to him that he try writing with other people as well as me. Not that there was anything wrong with our relationship, either professionally or personally, but maybe a change of scenery would do us both good. Everything came to a head on the penultimate night of the Madison Square Garden residency. Backstage, I told the band that I couldn't do it anymore. They could have another year's wages as severance pay, but there would be no more tours for the foreseeable future. Towards the end of the show, I mumbled something non-committal about going away for a while. The minute I said it, I couldn't work out whether I really meant it or not. On the one hand, I clearly couldn't carry on like this, schlepping around the world. I'd convinced myself it was the root of all my problems. It was why I was so knackered. It was why my relationships never worked out. It was why I was unhappy. On the other, I still loved playing live. And I'd been on the road since I was 18. It was my job. I didn't really know adult life without it. What was I going to do all day? Watch Durf put shelves up and listen to a minor bird telling me to piss off every 10 minutes? So I was in a thoughtful mood when the journalist from Rolling Stone arrived at my hotel. He was called Cliff Jar, and he'd been pestering for an interview for weeks. I had no idea that Cliff was an out and proud gay man who'd turned up determined to find out the truth about my sexuality. I don't think he saw it as a political thing. Outing people wasn't really viewed as striking a blow against a repressive society back then. I think he was just a hungry freelancer after a scoop. I later learned that Cliff had an elaborate plan to wheedle the information out of me. It involved a secret code word that he was going to drop into the conversation as a signal for the photographer to leave the room, at which point he would deploy his journalist's guile to get me to confess my darkest secret to him. Bless him. He didn't get the chance to put his meticulous plan into action. I brought the subject up before he did. He asked me if I was in love with anyone, which was very much the wrong question to ask me in those days, unless you had a few hours to spare, and a burning desire to fill them listening to me moaning about the terrible state of my personal life. I started telling him how desperate I was to find someone to love. I despairingly wondered aloud if relationships with women might not be longer lasting than the relationships I'd had with men. He looked a little taken aback and, to his immense credit, asked if I wanted him to turn his tape recorder off and speak off the record. I said no. Fuck it. It honestly didn't seem like that big an issue. Everyone around me had accepted I was gay years before. Everyone in the music business knew about my relationship with John Reed. And it really can't have been that much of a shock for Cliff Jar, given that I'd previously told him the story of Divine and me being turned away from Crisco Disco. Let's look at the circumstantial evidence. I'd been trying to get into a gay club, named after a famous anal lubricant with the world's most famous drag queen. The news that I wasn't heterosexual could hardly have come as a bolt from the blue. He asked me if I was bisexual. And I said yes. You can see that as fudging the issue if you want, but in fairness, I'd had a relationship with a woman before, and I had a relationship with a woman afterwards. He asked if Bernie and I were ever a couple, and I told him we weren't. John Reed's name came up, and I fibbed and said I'd never had a serious affair with anyone. It certainly wasn't my business to start outing anyone in Rolling Stone. I told him I thought everyone should be able to go to bed with whoever they wanted, but they should draw the line at goats. I added. At that moment, John Reed suddenly stuck his head round the door and asked if everything was all right. I don't know whether it was just perfect timing or whether he'd been listening at the door in a state of mounting panic and finally, when I started making jokes about bestiality, couldn't stand it any longer. Perhaps he drew the line at goats too. I told John everything was fine, and I meant it. I didn't feel relieved or nervous or proud or any of the things you might expect to feel when you publicly come out. I didn't feel anything, really. I'd done all the fretting I had to do about my sexuality and what people might think about it years ago. I didn't care. This was not an attitude that was shared by those around me. Not that anyone said anything directly to me. Respectful of the amount of money I was earning everyone, and wary of our old friend the Dwight family temper to put in one of its show-stopping guest appearances, they wouldn't have dared. But around the time the feature came out, I got the feeling that John Reed and my American record company were in a state of anxiety, waiting to see what disastrous impact its revelations were going to have on my career. Eventually the dust settled, and the full, staggering extent of the damage I had caused became clear. There wasn't any. A couple of nutcases wrote into Rolling Stone and said they were praying that my perverted soul be spared God's wrath and eternal damnation. A few radio stations in the US announced they weren't going to play my records anymore, but that didn't bother me in the slightest. At the risk of sounding arrogant, I strongly suspected my career would limp on somehow without their help. People have said the Rolling Stone piece caused a dip in my record sales in the States, but my album sales had started to dip long before then. Rock of the Westies may have got to number one, but it had sold far less than Captain Fantastic. In Britain, meanwhile, the Sun newspaper cancelled a competition to win copies of Blue Moves on the grounds that its cover, a beautiful Patrick Proctor painting I owned of people sitting in a park, didn't feature any women, and thus presumably constituted terrifying homosexual propaganda from which the public must be protected. Their logic seemed to be that if a Sun reader saw a painting of some men sitting in a park, they might immediately rip off their wedding ring, abandon their wife and children, and race to the nearest gay bar singing "I Am What I Am" as they went. But that was about as far as adverse reactions went. Actually, the British press seemed less interested in what was happening in my sex life than what was happening on top of my head. In one sense, I couldn't blame them. I'd been pretty gripped by what was going on up there myself for the last year or so. My hair had started thinning a little in the early 70s, but a bad dye job in New York had suddenly caused the stuff to stage a mass walkout. Impressed by the way the fashion designer Zandra Rhodes seemed to change her hair colour to match her outfits, I had been getting mine dyed every shade imaginable at a salon in London for years with no apparent ill effects. I've no idea what the New York hairdresser had put on it, but not long afterwards it started coming out in chunks. By the time of the 1976 tour, there was virtually nothing left on top. I hated how I looked. Some people are blessed with the kind of face that looks good with a bald head. I am not one of those people. Without hair, I bear a disturbing resemblance to the cartoon character Shrek. But salvation was apparently at hand. I was directed to a man called Pierre Puteau in Paris, who was supposedly a great pioneer in the art of hair transplants. At that point in history, hair transplants were so new that any doctor who could be bothered to do them counted as a great pioneer. But I was assured he was the best. Undergo a simple procedure, I was told, and I would leave his Paris clinic a changed man. To cries of "Incroyable" and "Sacre bleu" from onlookers dazzled by my new leonine coiffure. It didn't quite work out like that. For one thing, it wasn't a simple procedure at all. It went on for 5 hours. I had it done twice, and both times it hurt like hell. The technique they used had the unappetizing name of strip harvesting. They took strips of hair from the back of my head with a scalpel and attached them to the crown. The sound of the hair being removed was disconcertingly like a rabbit gnawing its way through a carrot. I left the clinic after the first procedure reeling in agony. Lost my footing as I tried to get into the back of a waiting car and hit the top of my head on the door frame. It was at that moment I discovered that however much a hair transplant hurt, it was a mere pinprick compared to the sensation of hitting your head on a car door immediately after having a hair transplant. Frantically dabbing my now bleeding scalp with a tissue, I did the one thing I could think of that might take my mind off the pain I was in. I told the driver to take me shopping. To make matters worse, the hair transplant just didn't work. I'm not sure why, but it didn't take. It wasn't the doctor's fault. Perhaps it had something to do with the amount of drugs I was taking. Perhaps it had something to do with the fact that the one thing they told me I must not do in the weeks after the procedure was wear a hat. Advice I chose to completely ignore on the grounds that without a hat, I now look like something that turns up towards the end of a horror film and starts strip harvesting teenage campers with an axe. My head was covered in scabs and weird craters. I suppose I could have split the difference and worn something lighter than a hat, like a bandana. But appearing in public dressed as a gypsy fortune teller seemed a look too far, even for me. When news of recent events at Monsieur Pluteau's clinic reached the press, they went crazy. Nothing I'd done in my career to date seemed to fascinate them in quite the way that having a hair transplant did. The paparazzi became obsessed with getting a photo of me without a hat on. You would have thought I was hiding the secret of eternal life and happiness under there rather than a bit of thinning hair. The paparazzi were out of luck. I kept a hat on in public more or less permanently for the next decade or so. In the late 80s, just before I got sober, I decided I'd had enough. Dyed what was left of my hair platinum blonde and appeared that way on the cover of my album Sleeping with the Past. After I got sober, I had a weave done where they take what's left of your hair and attached more hair to it. I debuted my new look at the Freddie Mercury tribute concert. A writer noted that I looked like I had a dead squirrel on my head. He was mean, but I was forced to concede he also had a point. Eventually, I gave up and got a hairpiece made by the same people who make wigs for Hollywood movies. It's the strangest thing. People were absolutely obsessed with my hair, or lack of it, for years. Then I started wearing a wig, and virtually no one's mentioned it since. That said, a wig is not without drawbacks of its own. A few years back, I was sleeping at my home in Atlanta when I woke up to the sound of voices in the apartment. I was convinced we were being burgled. I pulled on my dressing gown and started creeping out to see what was happening. I was halfway down the corridor when I realised I didn't have my hairpiece on. I rushed back to the bedroom, reasoning that if I was going to be bludgeoned to death by intruders, at least I wouldn't be bald when it happened. Wig on, I went into the kitchen to find two workmen who'd been sent up to fix a leak. They apologised profusely for waking me up, but despite my relief, I couldn't help noticing they were staring at me. Perhaps they were starstruck, I thought, as I headed back to bed. Stopping off in the bathroom, I realised that the workmen weren't bedazzled by the sight of the legendary Elton John appearing before them. They were bedazzled by the sight of the legendary Elton John appearing before them with his wig on back to front. I looked completely ridiculous, like Frankie Howard after a heavy night in a strong wind. I took the thing off and went back to sleep. If the world at large seemed to take the news about my sexuality very well, I did start to wonder if I could perhaps have timed the announcement a little better. One piece of advice I would give anyone planning on publicly coming out is this. Try and make sure you don't do it immediately after being appointed chairman of a British football club, unless you want to spend your Saturday afternoons listening to thousands of away supporters singing to the tune of My Old Man Said Follow the Van. Don't sit down when Elton's around or you'll get a penis up your ass. I suppose I should deliver a lecture here decrying the homophobia of football fans in the mid-70s, but I have to be honest. I thought it was funny. Mortifying, but funny. I didn't feel threatened or frightened by it. It was obviously good-humoured. You had to take it on the chin. They'd sing it and I'd just smile and wave at them. In fact, when it came to Watford FC, I had far bigger problems to deal with than whatever the opposition supporters were singing. It was a Watford supporting journalist who came to interview me back in 1974 who first mentioned that the club was in trouble, and not just on the pitch. I still followed them avidly, still went and watched them whenever I could. Still stood on the bend, the same place on the terrace at Vicarage Road where I'd stood with my dad as a kid. Standing there wasn't the only thing about watching them that brought back childhood memories. Watford was still just as hopeless a team as they had been in the 50s, permanently stuck at the bottom of the Football League. Supporting them sometimes made me think of being a member of Bluesology. I loved them to bits, but I knew we were going absolutely nowhere. Thanks to the journalist, I now learned that the club was in financial trouble too. They had no money because no one was interested in coming to watch them lose every week. They were desperately looking for ways to make some. I rang them up and suggested I could play a benefit gig at the ground. They agreed and in return offered me the chance to buy shares in the club and become vice chairman. For the gig, I dressed up in a bee outfit, the closest thing I could find to the club's mascot, a cartoon hornet called Harry, and brought Rod Stewart along to perform with me. If nothing else, this provided Rod with an afternoon of unceasing hilarity at the awfulness of Watford's ground, which admittedly was a crumbling dump, still with a greyhound track running around the pitch. The abysmal nature of the team's results, in contrast to his beloved Celtic, and especially my new role as vice chairman. "What the fuck do you know about football, Sharon?" he asked. "If you knew anything, you wouldn't support this lot." I told him to fuck off. The rest of the board couldn't have been more welcoming. If they were bothered about having the only vice chairman in the Football League who turned up to meetings with green and orange hair, towering over everyone else because of his platform souls, they never mentioned it. But my presence didn't seem to be making much difference to Watford itself. The team was still hopeless, and the club was still broke. A thought kept playing on my mind. If supporting Watford was as frustrating as being in Bluesology, then maybe, as in Bluesology, it was down to me to do something about it. So when the chairman, a local businessman called Jim Bonser, offered to sell me the club outright in the spring of 1976, I said yes. John Reid was furious, going on and on about what a drain on my finances owning a football club was going to be. I told him to fuck off too. I really wanted to do this. I've always had a competitive streak, whether it was squash or table tennis or Monopoly. Even today, if I play tennis, I don't want to just knock a ball about and get some exercise. I want to play a game and I want to win. So taking on the chairman's job appealed to that aspect of my character. I liked the challenge. What's more, I was sick of having my weekends ruined because Watford had lost. And I loved the club. Supporting Watford was something that ran through my whole life, while everything else had changed beyond recognition. Vicarage Road was 5 or 6 miles from where I was born. It connected me to my roots, reminded me that no matter how successful I was, or how famous, or how much money I made, I was still a working-class boy from a council house in Pinner. But there was something else too. I loved being around the club because everything about it was different from the music world I usually inhabited. There was no glamour, no luxury, no limousines, no starship. You got on the train to Grimsby with the players, you watched the game, listened to the opposition supporters sing about your allegedly insatiable desire to stick your penis up the arse of anyone nearby, and then you got the train home, carrying a box of local fish the Grimsby directors had presented you with as a gift at the end of the match. There was no bullshit. Once you reached a certain level of success in the music business, you realise that a lot of people around you have started telling you what they think you want to hear, rather than what they actually think. No one wants to upset you. No one wants to rock the boat. But at Watford, it wasn't like that. The staff and players were friendly, they were respectful, but they weren't interested in massaging my ego. They would happily tell me if they didn't think much of my new album. "Why don't you do a song like Daniel again? I like that one." Or if they thought the coat I was wearing looked ridiculous. That I wasn't getting any kid glove treatment because I was Elton John was brought home quite forcefully whenever I elected to join in a five-a-side game with them. I'd get the ball, see a Watford player on the opposite team come in to tackle me, and the next thing I knew, they'd have possession and I'd be flying through the air at high speed backwards as a prelude to landing flat on my arse. And there was no bad behaviour, no diva tantrums from me. I had to learn to be a good loser, to shake the hands of the opposition's directors when they beat us. I couldn't lose my temper or sulk, nor could I get drunk or take drugs, because I wasn't there as a huge star whose every whim had to be catered for. I was there as a representative of Watford Football Club. I broke the rules once. I turned up at a Boxing Day game hungover after a mammoth coke bender and started helping myself to the boardroom scotch. The following day I was given a real dressing down, the kind of telling off no one ordinarily had the balls to deliver to me. "What the fuck do you think you're doing? You're letting yourself down and you're letting the club down." The man delivering the talking to was Graham Taylor, the new manager I'd personally convinced to join Watford in April 1977. He was 32 years old when I met him, young for a football manager, and he reminded me of Bernie. Like Bernie, he came from Lincolnshire. Like Bernie, he took a chance on me. Graham was paid very well for a manager of a team as lowly as Watford, but taking the job was definitely a step down for him. He had already taken his last team, Lincoln City, out of the 4th Division and was supposed to move on to somewhere much bigger, not go back to the bottom. But, like Bernie, I clicked with him immediately. And, like Bernie, I didn't interfere with what he did. I just let him get on with doing his job. And, like Bernie, when things took off for us, they took off in a way beyond anything we could have imagined. Graham was an incredible manager. He assembled a fantastic backroom team around him. Bertie Mee came from Arsenal to be his assistant, a veteran who'd been a player in the 30s and knew the game inside out. Eddie Plumley arrived from Coventry as chief executive. Graham bought new players and encouraged amazing young talent. He signed John Barnes, aged 16, one of the greatest players England's ever seen. And Graham got him for the price of a new football kit. He turned club apprentices like Luther Blissett and Nigel Callaghan into star players. He made them all train harder than they'd ever trained before. And he got them to play exciting football. Two big centre forwards, two fast wingers, a great attack, lots of goals, which meant that people wanted to come and watch us. He got rid of the Greyhound track and built new stands and a family enclosure, a place specifically designed for parents to bring their kids to watch the game in safety. Every team has one now, but Watford were the first. All of this cost money, which meant more moaning from John Reid. I didn't care. I wasn't a businessman pouring cash into the club as a financial investment. Watford were in my blood. I was obsessed to the point that I became superstitious. If we were on a winning streak, I wouldn't change my clothes or empty my pockets. And so insanely enthusiastic, I could literally talk people into becoming Watford fans. I converted my old friend Muff Winwood from a West Brom supporter to a member of the Watford board. I went to local council meetings and tried in vain to convince them to let us build a new stadium on the outskirts of the town. After matches, I'd go to the supporters' club, a little building on the main stand, meet with Watford fans and listen to what they had to say. I wanted them to know that I really cared about the club, that we weren't taking them for granted, that without the supporters, Watford was nothing. I threw huge parties for the players and staff and their families at Woodside, with five-a-side games and egg and spoon races. I bought an Aston Martin, had it painted in Watford's colours, yellow with a red and black stripe down the middle, and drove to away games in it. I called it the chairman's car. I didn't realise how much attention it had attracted until I was introduced to Prince Philip. We were making polite conversation when he suddenly changed the subject. Yes, you live near Windsor Castle, don't you? He asked. Have you seen the bloody idiot who's driving round that area in his ghastly car? It's bright yellow with a ridiculous stripe on it. Do you know him? Yes, Your Highness, it's actually me.
Really?
He didn't appear particularly taken aback by this news at all. In fact, he seemed quite pleased to have found the idiot in question so that he could give him the benefit of his advice.
What the hell are you thinking? Ridiculous! It makes you look like a bloody fool. Get rid of it.
If the chairman's car couldn't get me to the game on time, I'd charter a helicopter. If I couldn't make it because I was abroad, I would phone the club and they would plug my call into the local hospital radio broadcast of the match. Backstage, somewhere in America, the band would listen to me in my dressing room, alone, screaming my head off because we'd beaten Southampton in a cup tie. If it was the middle of the night in New Zealand, I'd get up to listen. If it clashed with the start of the gig, I'd delay the start of the gig. I loved it. The excitement of the games. The feeling of camaraderie, of being part of a team where it felt like everyone was working towards the same end, from the players to the tea ladies. I couldn't have bought the personal happiness that Watford brought me at any price. Besides, I wasn't throwing money into a bottomless pit. I could see the results of my spending. Watford started winning and kept winning. After one season, we were into the third division. After two, we were in the second. In 1981, Watford were promoted to the first division for the first time in their history. The next year, we were runners-up, the second most successful football team in Britain. It meant we would be playing in the UEFA Cup against the biggest teams in Europe, Real Madrid, Bayern Munich, Inter Milan. That was what I'd told Graham I'd wanted the club to achieve at our first meeting. He had looked at me like I was out of my mind and started telling me how we'd be lucky to stay in the fourth division with the team we had. You've got a fucking giraffe for a centre forward, before realising I was deadly serious and prepared to put my money where my mouth was. We decided it would probably take 10 years. Watford had done it in 5. And then, in 1984, we made the FA Cup final. It's the oldest and most prestigious football competition in Britain. Wembley Stadium, 100,000 fans. I was used to Watford doing well by now. It's funny how easily you become accustomed to success after decades of failure. But just before the match started, it suddenly hit me how far we had come. From a hopeless little club that no one went to watch, that people laughed at, to this. The brass band struck up with Abide With Me, the traditional FA Cup hymn, and that was it. I burst into tears in full view of the BBC's cameras. As it turned out, that was the highlight of the day. We were beaten 2-0 by Everton. Should have been a much closer game. One of their goals should have been disallowed. But ultimately they played better than we did. I was distraught. But we still threw a party for the team. It was a fantastic achievement. Looking out at the crowd at Wembley before the game began, I'd felt like I had on stage at Dodgers Stadium. And, like the Dodger Stadium gigs, I think I knew that this was a sort of pinnacle. That it didn't get any better than this. I was right. A couple of years later, Graham left to become manager at Aston Villa. I appointed a manager called Dave Bassett as his replacement, but it didn't work out. The chemistry wasn't right. He didn't gel with the team. I started thinking that I should have left Watford when Graham did. I still loved the club, but there had been a serendipity, a magic about the two of us together, and I couldn't conjure up that same magic without him. Eventually, I sold Watford to Jack Petchy, a multi-millionaire who'd made his money in cars. 7 years later, I bought back a load of shares in the club and became chairman again, a businessman rather than someone who put his heart into the club. I felt Jack was making a terrible mess of things, and Watford had slipped back into the second division. I only did it because Graham agreed to come back as manager. The team did well, but it wasn't the same as the first time around. There wasn't that incredible challenge of rising from the bottom. Finally, Graham left again, and this time so did I. I resigned as chairman for good in 2002. In a weird way, our partnership quietly continued, right up until he died in 2017. I still rang Graham all the time to talk about the team, how they were playing, what we thought of the latest manager. Whatever else Graham Taylor achieved in football, nothing took his heart away from Watford. I'm incredibly proud of what we achieved together, but I owe Watford far more than Watford owe me. I was chairman throughout the worst period of my life, years of addiction and unhappiness, failed relationships, bad business deals, court cases, unending turmoil. Through all of that, Watford were a constant source of happiness to me. When I didn't feel I had any love in my personal life, I knew I had love from the club and the supporters. Gave me something else to concentrate on, a passion that could take my mind away from everything that was going wrong. For obvious reasons, there are chunks of the 80s I have no recollection of. I struggled to remember what had happened the next day, let alone 30 years later. But every Watford game I saw is permanently etched on my memory. The night we knocked Manchester United out of the League Cup at Old Trafford, when we were still a third division side. 2 goals by Blissett, both headers. The newspapers that never normally bothered writing about Watford calling them Elton John's Rocket Men the next morning. The night in November 1982, when we were away to Nottingham Forest in the Milk Cup, they beat us 7-3. But I thought it was one of the greatest games of football I'd ever seen in my life. And Forest's legendary manager Brian Clough agreed with me, before turning to Graham and telling him he would never allow his chairman to sit on the bloody touchline the way I did. If I hadn't had the football club, then God knows what would have happened to me. I'm not exaggerating when I say I think Watford might have saved my life.